I'd like to speak tonight about life is the treasure. Last night, among other things, spoke about the forms of distorted perception. Tonight I want to talk about clear perception. Sometimes clear perception would be better described as realization. Let me preface this by saying that words about realization, words actually about anything, only point at those things. They're not those things. Okay, so this is not a carpet. Can I get away with that? So what is it then? A better way to know the carpet, other than to call it the carpet and then go on describing a carpet, would be to touch it and close one's eyes and get into this directly. So words about realization are pointing at it. They're not it. The Buddha was very thorough in his life teachings, what he offered this world, what he offered us, what he's still offering us. When I say he, I don't mean a person, historical person. What I mean is the awakened nature, the Buddha nature. What that's offering us. Because in a way, anything that happens here that's truly sensed or felt as really good, in a way, is coming from that. It's coming from that nature. Because that nature is wholesome. That nature is pure. That nature is us. In our core. Direct and clear perception of what is occurring ends living in anticipation of something to come and ends strategies of avoidance. Life is happening in free form. Life happening in free form, when realized, releases the human being from needs and wants. The opportunity that we're sharing is the opportunity to fall out of living in anticipation and avoidance. Falling out of anticipation and avoidance could also be described as going beyond anticipation and avoidance. If you consider this, anticipation is a pull towards something. While avoidance is pushing away from something. Life is happening in free form. Why do we like at times to just gaze into the sky? Or to just watch the clouds unfolding in the sky? Why do we like that? Because what we're looking at is life unfolding itself in free form. And if we fall into the sky, or we fall into the clouds moving in the sky, there can be a moment or more where you're not here, where you, in a way, disappear. This you disappearing happens throughout many, many days for many, many people without any interest in these things that we're doing here or any kind of so-called spiritual sort of, you know, information coming to them. People are sitting in movie theaters right now watching, you might even call them ridiculous movies, losing themselves. The eye is disappearing. And you can see this happening in people's faces sometimes. They're falling out of separation. And you could say, well, they're just getting lost in the movie. You see, but people in sports have this. They get absorbed in the sport. They get absorbed in the music. The eye disappears. And then it comes back. What we're playing with here is the possibility that this opening into free form can occur in complete clarity. That it's not just a kind of a shift and, you know, one doesn't really know what's happening, so to speak. Or the opening occurs and then you might say the aperture on the camera closes. One's sort of back to oneself and one goes, what was that? So thinking about something that just seemed to happen there, figuring it out. Talking about realization occurring here and now. In order to, in a way, support this realization, what has to occur is that our conceptualization of realization has to be taken apart. Even how the mind might right now be considering what free form life is. Even as the mind might think about, oh yeah, yeah, I know what that was like for me when I went to the movies, or when I looked at the sky, or when I saw the clouds unfolding, or when that music was happening, and it was just the music. Or me and the music became one. Mind can still be thinking about that, you see? Life happening in free form has a counterpoint within it. The counterpoint within life happening in free form is a subtle or not so subtle, sometimes profoundly unsettling, sense of disquiet, a sense of struggle, and most importantly, a belief in being someone who can achieve or attain something different than what's happening. That's the counterpoint to the free fall or the free form. And this disquiet, this sense of struggle, this belief in I am someone who can attain or achieve something different than what's happening, specifically and pointedly, if that that is happening is disquietedness, is struggle. I can achieve something beyond this or other than this. Belief in someone who can transcend the disquiet or attain something better than what's happening. We never really know what this is, but it's conceived as somehow different. It's conceived as some kind of release or relief from the disquiet and the struggle. From the moment the sense of separation arises, two things fall out of that. One is bewilderment or confusion, and the other is seeking. The seeking attempts to resolve or end the disquiet of the bewilderment or the confusion born from the sense of separation. Every human being, at least in moments in their life, longs for happiness, for freedom, for connectedness, for absence of separation. And if we look around, we can see that the way people go about relief from separation is quite wild and bizarre. So from the moment of separation, we don't have a sense, in most cases, when that happened. But if there's a sense of separation, a feeling, perception of separation, there is a point at which it was born. And you could do a lot of hypnosis, a lot of regression, and you could go and try to find that. You could go back and do some rebirthing. You could have Stanislav Grof and his colleagues work you over with very evocative music and breathing. And if you really needed to ramp it up, you could sneak off into a side room and have the music on and the breathing and LSD. And you might find something of that moment when separation first arose. So what? Then what would you do? I found the moment where it began. I'm not saying it makes no sense to have some sense of relative order in the so-called past. Because if you're sitting here and what comes up are memories and there's emotion in those memories and those memories are painful, they need some care and attention. That's why they're coming up. But intentionally going back and trying to figure out all of what happened back there, all the way back to the point of separation, what is that going to do for you? Other than tidy up something called your tail. I now got my tail ordered. The idea in the mind of some humans is that if I get the past really ordered and I get it all kind of shaped out and I understand, I have insight about all that, now I don't have to think about it. Now I can live here. Now I can be here. Now I'm not going to be disquieted by what is incomplete or unresolved back there. And if You think about this a little bit, it makes some sense. It has some relative value. But let me say this very clearly. You, so to speak, are not going to resolve the sense of separation by finding out when it first began. You might, if you ever had any discomfort towards one of your parents for how they treated you, you might go back and remember some of that stuff and come up with a more open heart, a more understood awareness, you might say, of their own difficulties that they couldn't help but bring into your life stream. And maybe some forgiveness will fall out of that. Maybe some understanding and transformation will come out of that. I'm talking now about something a little bit different than getting the past ordered. That's a little bit like getting one room in your house called the past feng shuied. Okay. There's a lot more to us or the house than the one room. We don't actually often see this, but we're living in a mansion. It's not the Franciscan Center. We're living in a mansion. And this mansion is the mansion of being. What fuels most of the religious and spiritual movements and their movements on this planet is the sense of separation. These movements form in an attempt to help humans find something that is believed to be attainable, something better than what's happening, either sooner or later. Either later or now. And if the view, it's a view, is that it's attainable, achievable later, that's called a progressive path. If the view is that it's attainable now, that's a direct path. And all of the religious or spiritual traditions fall into these two groupings, either progressive path or direct path. In the Buddhist teachings, as they flowered out over the centuries, there's both direct path teachings and progressive path teachings. When you hear a teaching like, there are skillful means, there's a way to understand these skillful means and apply these skillful means. Like right action, right livelihood, right speech. And you practice these skillful means, your life can become more harmonious. Your life can become more contented. When you hear a teaching like, there is no one breathing, that's a direct path instruction. That the conceptual mind sometimes has a hard time with. Because the conceptual mind believes at times, I am breathing. So what's he talking about? It doesn't necessarily make sense. But in experiencing the breath as it truly is, and in just an instant where it's realized the breath is breathing itself, there can be a clarity that there's no one doing it. And so all of a sudden that instruction makes sense. There's no one breathing. And that happens in the immediacy. And in some cases, simply just that, direct, immediate insight or realization, brings happiness, brings relief. Oh, I don't have to breathe. And it still happens. We forget that at night in sleep, breath is doing just fine. Going here, going there, moving, it's doing exactly what it needs to do. No one tending to it, no one watching it, no one doing it. It works perfect. We're sleeping, we miss it. These movements, these religious spiritual movements, they function to comfort human beings about the disquiet. They comfort human beings, or they hope to, about the struggle, about the hardships, about the difficulties, about the traumas, about the losses. And they're powerful because human beings come together in these movements. And since it becomes a social movement, it's a community, and we can talk about these things that bother us. We can talk about these things that matter to us. We can relate. And sometimes there's a leader of the movement. And if those leaders of the movement are not careful, they get in trouble. Because they themselves may believe that they have something that the others don't have. It's hard to not think that way sometimes if you ever stand up behind a pulpit and you're high up and that pulpit's in between you and those who are down there and they're looking up at you and you have robes on. It's a tricky position, wouldn't you say? Could really separate you if you think you're somebody other than those that are sitting there. So these movements, they function to help comfort the disquiet, the struggle, and the key point, to comfort the perception of I am a counterpoint from the free fall of life. I am somehow separate from the free fall of life. They function to comfort human beings about the perception of losing wholeness. Because as soon as the perception or feeling or belief in separation arises, there's some sense of contraction or diminishment of wholeness. They comfort human beings about paradise lost. They comfort human beings about getting chucked out of the Garden of Eden. They comfort human beings about separation. The anticipation of something to come is in fact the search itself. It's the seeking itself. The anticipation of something to come is the seeking itself. And in fact, this seeking itself is the disquiet itself. It's the struggle itself. Although the whole spiritual search, the whole spiritual journey is fueled by the sense of separation and false identification, it's critical to see that it's perfectly fine that it's happening. Because if a struggle, if a seeking is going on, and now there's somebody who says, that's not okay, well, we talked about that last night, didn't we? Isn't that the height of irrationality to say no to something that's already happening? And we're talking about here now, things that are happening, you know, in the context of this meditation. There's things in the world, there's things that are happening that once they start up, no is an appropriate response. It's an appropriate response to children when they're being raised at times. No. They started up something? No. It's an important activity when humans are relating with other humans at times. No, I'm not going to do that. You want me to do that? No, I changed my mind. But what I'm saying now is that it's perfectly fine that the spiritual journey is fueled by the sense of identification, false identification, and the sense of separation. It's perfectly fine. But it's also a strange truth that although the seeker never really knows what they're looking for, except what they imagine, this seeking is the biggest habit going on around here. It's the biggest habit going on around here with countless forms and expressions. The seeker doesn't realize and can never realize that what is happening as it's happening in its mysterious simplicity is what is being searched for. This is what it means when people say, you are already what you're looking for. Have you ever noticed how, in hearing and maybe reading, you are already what you're looking for, doesn't automatically end the seeking? The words are interesting, they're a kind of a flip over, turn inside out, but the seeking still goes on in many cases. We're still looking, even if we are thinking that what we're looking for, we already are that. We're still looking. Why? And here's one way to talk about why. What I'm talking about now is absolutely not about being here. It's not about being in the moment. The idea of being present, which is a major teaching in many spiritual movements, religious movements, become present, be present. You need to become present. Even in Vegas, above one of the doors of the casinos, it says, you have to be present to win. Ka-ching, ka-ching. And in the Vegas airport, I was just there a couple of weeks ago after some teaching, not in Vegas. Thank God. But ka-ching, you know, the people are in the airport. It's one of the only airports I've ever been in where you've got these ka-chingers right there in the airport, and people are almost doing it with both hands. Ka-ching, ka-ching. Just before the plane, ka-ching. The money in. Oh, boy. And if you're not present, then the casino wins even more. The idea of being present or being in the moment is often an attempt to become someone or something that's present. This is a concept. And it's often contrasted to what we view or experience as not being present. Like what? Lost in thoughts, feelings, caught up in stuff, conflicted. We think of that as not being present. Being present, okay? Feels better to initially rest back into my senses or my breathing after I've been up in here spinning around, or getting emotionally caught up in stuff. Come back to the simplicity of breathing and just awareness of the sensations. And I say, oh, I'm now more present. That's the idea, concept, that I have become more present. Now, the moment and I are all concepts. There is no now. There is no moment. There is no I. All there is what's happening. That which is happening we sometimes call the now. If there's an I who's experiencing the now, I say, I am being present. And I don't just say that, I believe it. I assume it, and I need it to spiritually evolve, because that's what the text said. It's a ka-ching. All there is what is happening. What is happening is presence. This is presence. Or you could say this is presencing itself as this. I think I'm present. Now I go, I'm the presence. What I'm saying is everything is presence. And this everything that's presence is wholeness or completeness. Wholeness or completeness contains limitation. Wholeness or completeness contains separation. It must, by definition, wholeness or completeness must have everything in it. So it contains the sense of constriction or contraction, and this constriction or contraction is actually the seeking itself. And this can be discovered. Let's say you sit, quote unquote, long enough, whatever that might be, and the whole thing relaxes. There's no more contraction or constriction anywhere. The whole thing loosens up. Okay? The only tension that will be remaining is the seeking, if it's there. Because the seeking believes in incompleteness. It believes that it's incomplete. And so it has to seek to find completeness. And in that seeking, there's grasping, there's wanting. When seeking falls away, even for an instant or longer, then what arises naturally is a causeless joy. It's the causeless joy of wholeness or oneness. It's an opening to unboundedness. Wanting to not seek is simply more seeking. So when the seeking is realized, there it is, there it is, there it is. Sometimes the mind will then go, okay, let me figure out how to not do that. So now I'm wanting to not seek. If seeking's going to happen, it's going to happen. And the fact is, without giving this any kind of a pejorative or negative spin, the fact of seeking arises helplessly. In other words, you, as you experience yourself, as the seeker, are helpless. I don't mean that in the sense that there is no help for that, but that you can't help it. It just happens. And it just happens because the sense of separation has arisen. And this life will not be complete, it will not be free, it will not be okay unless this sense of separation is resolved. Now, bear in mind, some human beings just tolerate the sense of separation. They just hang with it. And yet they seek satisfaction in other ways. They turn on the television and just watch. They turn on the television and they just watch, and then they fall asleep to the television. And then they wake up and they go to bed. And they get up and they do what they have to do. They get by. They tolerate the sense of separation, the sense of aloneness. They tolerate the disquiet. They go into a trance of tolerance. And it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing some degree of happiness, but their happiness is very muted. Their life experience is dulled. And they carry on. This happens for people in depression sometimes, when depression comes on very strongly for different reasons. Especially if the sense of depression has got a strong organic or chemical, biochemical part to it, then sometimes people just, it's just so black and difficult, they just tolerate it. But if you talk to them, they want the same thing that all of us want. They want relief. But they sometimes have given up, and sometimes doctors will say, you're going to be depressed for your whole life. Just accept it. Wanting to not seek is more seeking. If seeking is going to happen, it's going to happen. And yet, there can be an openness or readiness for it to be seen, for the seeking to be seen. And just as darkness dissolves in the presence of light, wanting or seeking dissolves in the openness of awareness. This is the whole essence of this whole event. Things can be seen in their true nature. When they're seen in their true nature, they reveal their true nature. The true nature of seeking is that it is impermanent. To seek is unsatisfactory. And when seeking is seen through, you get a bonus prize, and that is, it's revealed that there's no one seeking. Because if I'm the seeker and the seeker goes away, I just went with it. Boop. Something seems to be here even when seeking's gone. And that something that's here even when seeking's gone is presence itself. Openness itself. And here's the trickiest one. Oneness itself. Now watch how the mind works on this one, because it's a tricky area of the talk. Oneness cannot be known. It cannot be measured, because it's everywhere in everything. It's inconceivable and it's immeasurable. It can't be approached or attained because it's all there is. Okay? So this is oneness. This is wholeness. This is completeness right here. Oneness doesn't get bigger or smaller. In other words, it doesn't change in size. It can't be added to nor subtracted from. The word in Sanskrit, aveta, aveta means not to, or oneness, non-dual. It points to the futility of the idea that there is oneness and there is something or someone separate from oneness who's going to find it. Someone who's going to realize it. Someone who's going to see it. Someone who's going to live in it. I would like to move now into the house of oneness. Nothing doing. But in these, some of these direct path teachings, people, humans, tell other humans, yes, you are a separate being, and yes, you can realize oneness. You can realize non-duality. You can become whole. And that's completely and utterly false. Help us see why. What's difficult for the mind that wants to understand these matters right now is that these concepts being spoken are not pointing to more concepts. For example, the concept of oneness or wholeness or completeness has no other concepts to hook onto it. Like, where is oneness? Or where is oneness not? You can't even easily go, oneness is like a circle. A big circle. A really big circle. A circle without any edge. That's oneness. No, it's not. Any concepts about oneness are not oneness. And yet concepts are happening, you might say, as part of oneness. Everything that's happening is part of oneness. And even more to the point, everything that's happening is oneness. So to say it's part of oneness, then still, notice how the mind goes, oh, okay, it's part of, then there's something else other than that part. Everything is oneness or wholeness as itself. So this is pointing at something that's beyond understanding. Antonio Machado, the Spanish poet and school teacher, had a great haiku-like poem for this. He said, between living and dreaming, there's a third thing. Guess it. What is he pointing at? The idea that I am living, the idea that I am dreaming, has something in between it, and that's the free fall. That's the open sky. That's the wholeness or oneness or completeness. The appearance of limitation is the seeking or wanting tendency or habit. Yes, it's a habit. It's the deepest habit going. It actually is wholeness expressing itself as the habit of wanting. That's wholeness expressing itself as the habit of wanting. True freedom is absolutely not a condition. It's not a condition like the condition of the absence of limitation, which the mind often thinks it is. Freedom is the absence of limitation. That's what the mind thinks. True freedom is absolutely not a condition. Awakening is not a new identity or a new view. It's the end of identification and view. It's the end of needing and wanting. It's the end of seeking. The end of seeking and the end of identifying as and with anything. The need and wanting something to be different, or believing in something better. What's difficult for the mind is that what's being spoken about here has nothing to do with making your life work better. It's not about making your life work better. It's not about feeling better about yourself. It's not about having, you know, more comfortable sensations. It has nothing to do with that at all. This isn't about creating or getting better states, more comfortable states, more peaceful states. Nor is it about conceiving life through positive and negative views or attributes. Notice how easily the mind gives attributes to certain things as beauty. Those are positive attributes. And those positive attributes to that which one perceives as beautiful must be in contrast to one perceives as less beautiful or even ugly. True beauty isn't about attributes. True beauty is presence, expressing itself as everything. That's beyond positive and negative. This is about seeing the I am this or I am that view as the first fetter, and all other fetters, all other positive and negative views come from this, I am that tendency, and this creates the illusion of division. The illusion of division is the sense of separation. It's the sense of aloneness. It's the sense of apart from. Ultimately, all the struggle and all the seeking is about trying to end this illusion of division. And we have a myriad way of going about it. We're so involved in it at times that we become absolutely fascinated with the struggle. Absolutely seduced by the struggle. So seduced, so fascinated by the struggle, that at times for humans it consumes the whole waking state. And even if one distracts oneself from it and focuses on others, so to speak, and does some work, one stops doing that and one's back to the struggle. The struggle of dealing with me. And that me that I'm dealing with in that struggle is a me that feels separate and divided. The struggle is always about trying to make life better somehow. Awakenedness is not a state like concentration or happiness or joy or tranquility or confusion. Awakenedness is not a state, but rather it's the openness that all states happen in. Sense that for a moment. If you've had any states today or yesterday, maybe you've had a few, just notice the space that the states happen in. The states appear limiting to the sense of me or I because of their unpleasantness, because they are perceived somehow as a limitation because they're perceived somehow as unwanted. And the states don't give a hoot what I think about them. They say, here I am. Here I am. They don't bother to knock. They just walk right in. And they sit down and they start eating. And they hang around as long as they want. And then they go in their own time. Keep in mind, though, that they're viewed and they're felt a certain way, and that's what gives them their character. If they're afflictive, they're afflictive because of how they're viewed or felt. The only thing afflictive about joy for human beings is when the joy goes away. And it's not the joy that's afflictive, but it's the loss of the joy. But all that sadness and that fear and that anger and that confusion, that's afflictive all the way through as long as it's viewed as that. This is why in the culmination of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha gave the teachings very clearly how to live in virtue, how to gather your life, how to come into harmony in this body-mind process, and then out of that there's a possibility of awakening into the final steps of the Eightfold Path, which is how the mind, thinking mind, can begin to truly become a servant rather than a bugaboo, and right view. The culmination of the path is to see things clearly. So here again, it's very tricky. Waking up, ultimately, is not an event in time, and it's not a process. Waking up, or the death of seeking, is an instantaneous realization of singularity. The instant the seeker is seen through, all there is singularity, all there is wholeness and completeness. And then that can cloud over again. Okay, so some teachers talk about this as the movement from me-ing as I, me-ing, M-E-I-N-G, to being. Being, wholeness, completeness, boom, the me appears again, boom, the me dissolves. And back and forth it can go, kind of like a pendulum. And this is, in a way, one way to describe the awakening, or the appearance of a process of awakening. What I'm saying right now is that true awakening is not a process. It doesn't happen in time. Has nothing to do with progression. It's the end of progression. It's the end of process. And it's the end of time. And oddly enough, everyone in this room has been experiencing timelessness very simply in the moments where there's no conceptualization of time. That's timelessness. So again, very tricky here. There's no actual conditions that prepare for awakening. No process that leads up to it. And this is extremely difficult for our conceptual mind. Why are we doing all this stuff then, you might ask? Well, you don't have to be. You could be doing something else, but why would you be doing that? If you want to see clearly the nature of things, then this is as good a situation as any for that to happen. If you feel like you can see clearly by just walking in the park, and this happens to people too, or swinging on the swing, or, you know, hanging around, or lying back, or, you know, sitting as they sometimes used to do in Marin County when I lived out in California, it was great. Come to the Dharma talk, and Marin County has a bit of wealth, and so people would come in their lounge chairs, and they'd have their colas on either armchair, and they'd be sitting back nice and comfortable, ready for the Dharma talk. And me, with my judgmental mind, would say, this is not right. They're pointing their feet towards the teacher. That's wrong. Conditioning, right? Plus they're drinking colas. Maybe they're not drinking colas. They could be drinking alcoholic beverages. And they're listening to a Dharma talk. This is all messed up. It's being allowed. This is wrong. It should stop. This is all just going off over here. Judgment, commentary, This is not spiritual. This looks like Club Med. I'm not exaggerating. Some of these folks had it in both arms. So no process leads up to this. This is very difficult for our conceptual mind. Conceptual mind conceives of everything as process. It conceives of everything as progression, because the conceptual mind is time. The conceptual mind is time. The conceptual mind conceives of everything through how it thinks about it. You can't get ready for oneness any more than you can get ready to fall in love or control the weather. In fact, you as you perceive yourself are just a conceived form of wholeness in disguise. And this is no matter how you seem to be appearing or what you think you are. You are wholeness in disguise. The name of the game here is to take the disguise off. That's why the Tibetans say this that's being spoken of is too close to see. That which is too close to see points to that which is already here. We're looking into something that we hope is it, that we think is it, and where the looking is coming from is what we're looking for. It's like in the Upanishads, one of the best lines in the Upanishads to me, in the Kinayana Upanishad, it says, not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eye can see. Know this and this alone, to be Brahman, the eternal, not what people here adore. And it goes on and talks about the other senses, and it talks about the mind, and it repeats the same teaching. So it's pointing at how we're looking out, or we're looking in. You see, because people say, go inside, it's inside, find it inside. Now, honestly, folks, what have you found inside today and yesterday? And be honest, gobbledygook. Or relative smoothies of gobbledygook. It's smoothed out. What needs to be confronted is the seeking itself, whether it's seeking out there or seeking in here. Because that seeking is the I. That seeking is the identification with the idea or the belief that I am somebody who can achieve or attain something other than what is happening here. And that which is other than what's happening here ought to be better than this. Why else look for it? And the belief there, of course, and the perception and the feeling is this ain't enough. It ain't good enough. It needs to be improved. It needs to be adjusted. It needs to be transformed. It needs to be refined. So we need to realize it's perfectly fine, absolutely fine, for there to be the story of identification. Struggle and separation goes on as long as it needs to. Struggle and woeful states are wholeness appearing as struggle and wholesome states. This is why it's said that samsara is nirvana. Not samsara or perpetual wandering or woeful states will become nirvana. Samsara is nirvana because wholeness or completeness is expressing itself through those woeful or afflicted states.
the shift.
And it's a shift. It's a huge monumental shift. It leaves everything the same and nothing the same simultaneously.
The shift is into seeing that these states are by nature changing, that there's no I or me in them,
and they eventually fall out into their true nature, which is wholeness or completeness.
So as I said last night, without losing your life as you think you have it,
there can never be an end of seeking.
Until there is a letting go of what can't be kept, there can never be a realization of what can't be lost. The conceptual mind, which can only perceive in terms of process and progression, is threatened by awakening and wholeness.
Awakening and wholeness, if we don't get it in the waking state, it comes close in the deep sleep state. We're actually closer to being awake in our true nature when we're asleep in many cases than when we're awake. That's why it feels so good to be nobody there, just and I used to contemplate this as a kid. I used to go, who set it up like this? Who set this up? And that more further into further seeking of understanding. When sex was discovered, then it was like, who set this up? This one, whoa, who set this up? Is this a mistake? Is this like, what is this? Is this described in the Upanishads? Fortunately, that particular seeking didn't last all that long. Who set this up? So, very clear now, the conceptual mind that only perceives in terms of progress and progression is threatened by awakening and wholeness. It's threatened by immediacy. It's threatened by cessation. It's threatened by death. It's even threatened by dying. We don't know what death is, but we do know what dying is. You know what dying is? Your breath came and it went. That breath just died. Thought came and it went. That thought just died. We know all about dying. We don't know nothing about death. We just, as Semedo said last night, we invest and we identify with the perception of death as this thing dies, and then we become afraid if we believe we are this. And we need to keep this. And then we start clinging to this perception of existence as a body-mind process. Isn't it weird that by nature this is supposed to croak? Naturally, just as it's supposed to move and do this and that, it's supposed to get wrinkly, things are supposed to fall out, shrink, it's supposed to do all that stuff, and we're saying no. It shouldn't do that. Or in my case, as this started to fall out, it was really totally okay for that to happen on anybody else's head, but not this head. And then people go, well, there's a reason for that, because there's a gene on the mother's side, and if the gene's on the mother's side, if the hair fell out on the, you know, on that side of the family, then you're going to have it. It's just there. It's just like another theory, another idea about why things are happening. All that also is about trying to comfort. So let's comfort that which inevitably must happen. Sickness, old age, and death. Buddha said, work with it. Get clear about this stuff. Know it now. Awake to dying now, and then living is more liberated. So that conceptual mind senses its death, a potential death, in awakening. It senses that its head is on the chopping block. And what it doesn't and can't get is that all it means that its head is on the chopping block is that it doesn't get to be the head of the table anymore. It's just going to move over. People go, oh, my conceptual mind's going to get blown out and I'm going to be completely dysfunctional in wholeness. You know, oneness takes over and then I'm a dysfunctional human being. It's the exact opposite. The personality, the structure of thinking, these things tend to, most beings, work a lot more easily and freely when they're not identified with as what and who I am, singularly. And that's like a byproduct of the meditation. As this meditation goes on and develops, people's conceptual minds, which sometimes during the retreat can't work. Like I remember clearly experiencing numerous times, no matter how hard I tried in the middle of the meditation or during the lunch period, not being able to spell the word the. It was like glue. It just wouldn't, like, go. Just the. I'd say it to myself like that and then go. I get like tea, and it wouldn't open. Okay, I go back to this. So eating my cereal. Because the conceptual mind isn't needed. It's not needed here. You don't have to make decisions. The bell rings, come in. Somebody says this, you go eat. You don't have to make any decisions. You don't have to figure anything out. And people go, well, in awakening then I'm just going to be a blob and I won't be able to function and won't be able to make decisions and I won't be able to do anything. All I'm really talking about is that conceptual mind, instead of being right up here going, I'm doing it, I'm running the show, keeping it together, it just goes, doink. And what happens in a way is the heart goes, oh, thank you. I get to be guiding. Instead of the thinking guiding, the feeling guiding, I get to guide. Thank you so much. And in a way, this becomes a servant of this, instead of this being on top of this, holding it, and even crushing it sometimes. Meanwhile, the heart is so kind, it's so nice, it doesn't even say, get off me. It just kind of takes it. And the chest can collapse as it takes it, and the back can hurt as it takes it, because it's like weighing down, it's the burden, it's like a backpack on the head. All I'm saying is that this loses it. It loses its centrality. Okay? It's completely wrong that it just goes and can't work anymore. There was a time in the stream of this body-mind process, not some other body-mind process, all of these body-mind processes, there was a time when this conceptual mind was not there. And the best example I can give of that, it may have happened for some of us, whether you remember it or not, the parents took you to the beach and they let you loose, or you got loose. Okay, it's much better to get loose than to be released. Because it's much more fun if you sneak away when they're not looking. So there you are, you sneak away when you're not looking, or they let you go either by mistake or they went, let's try it. Let's let him go and see what he does. And then they turn for a second and they look the other way. And here's the sin, and you go. You don't need anybody to come on and say, you know what? That sand, don't put it in your mouth. Okay? It's clear. You have a clear realization. That doesn't fit in there very well. That doesn't mean they're separate. It just means no. In, out. Don't have to think about it. Don't have to figure it out. Don't have to do a theory. Don't have to conceptualize it. That period of time is sort of a dream. In some room of the house that we call the memory room. And we see that memory room again when we look at a little one who's non-conceptually present And the best way I can put that is when you drop into their eyes, they beam you up, Scotty. They just go, and it's so clear there's no one in there conceptualizing this life. It's just being. And we go, oh, Paulie is so cute. Look at him. He's beaming. Kiss him. Click, 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 click. Do it again. Do it again. Look at the camera, Paulie. And we just do all kinds of stuff with that. We turn it into something, and it's just utterly beautiful and still and open. We are that. So the conceptual mind has this fear of losing control. Meanwhile, it's never been in control. It just thinks it's in control. It's never been in control. And even if it sort of seems to get a sense of control, all it's done is quarantined a part of life and gone, here, gotcha. And it's created its little pocket of security. So, again, very subtle point here. Any state or feeling isn't just opening. It already is open upon appearance. Okay, so to say every state is opening, every state is transitory, every state comes and goes. Okay, that's progressive. Right? To say every state, everything is already open upon appearance. It's free upon appearance. That's immediate. There's no path to that. That's just pop. But many Advaita teachers or direct path teachers will say, you can realize that. No, you can't. You can't realize that. You can't realize something that you already are. All that happens is a shift into clearly seeing that. Everything is open. Everything is free as itself already. Liberation from need. Times in the practice, liberation from wanting comes, and it can just carry on for days. There's no wanting at all. This wanting's just gone. Aversion can just completely go away, no aversion. But need is a different word than want, isn't it? Liberation from need, here it is. When it's clear that nothing needs to change, and yet everything by nature does change, that's freedom from need. Let me say it again. When it's clear that nothing needs to change, the sense of separation doesn't need to change. No state needs to change. No feeling needs to change. Nothing needs to change. That's liberation from need. Now, in order, in most cases, for the realization of liberation from need to arise, there often is, you might say, the insight into change. The insight into change just flowers open naturally into nothing needs to change. And in nothing needing to change, of course things do, and they will change, that's their nature. But in the realization that nothing needs to change, there's nobody here controlling it. life that many believe they have is a life where they're looking for the treasure. And some of us have been taught that treasure comes when you die. It's a strange form of this on our planet. It's more readily available to our conceptual minds through the media and through some of our global changes. And that is this, dare I say, somewhat insane teaching that if you join this movement and you engage in these terrorist acts and you take your life in so doing, you will be in paradise. It's a deep one, isn't it? It's a deep trance. So that's the better comes later. So for many people, their life is about looking for the treasure, either here or later. This life or some other life. The shift is into realizing that this life right here, as it is right now, as it's happening, it is the treasure. This is what the teachings say. This is what they point at. It's happening now. This is it. There is no now. There is no moment. But that which is happening is the wholeness or completeness. Nothing need be added or taken out. This is a revelation. It's the revelation that direct seeing or perception reveals, and that is the realization that life itself, as it is continually, is the treasure. That's home. Sometimes the poets do it the best justice, I feel. This is from Han San. Han San lived from 627 to 649. Consider that. Han San lived for 22 years, chronologically. Han San was a Zen master, poet, and hermit. Han San had a friend who was a cook in a Buddhist temple, and Han San would often visit the kitchen for leftovers. And many times Han San and his friend would sit together, eating and laughing uproariously. They're often depicted laughing together in both Chinese and Japanese paintings. This is Han San's poem. This poem is called My Home Was at Cold Mountain from the Start. My home was at Cold Mountain from the start, rambling among the hills, far from trouble. Gone, and a million things leave no trace. Loosened, and it flows through the galaxies, a fountain of light into the very mind. Not a thing, and yet it appears before me. Now I know the pearl of the Buddha nature, know its use, a boundless, perfect sphere. My home was at Cold Mountain from the start. Han San means cold mountain. Get that? His name is who he really is. And that's a literal translation. Han San means cold mountain. My home was at Cold Mountain from the start. Can you sit for me?